Hi, Small Subjects listeners. We want to hear from you. Click on the link on the blog where we post photos from each episode, www.boxdioramas.com/smallsubjects, or on our social media posts, and comment on anything we've said in this or any episode, or pose a question you'd like to hear us answer.
There's no time limit, but please try to focus your comments because we'd love to include them in full on the show. Thanks.
Hi everyone, it's Chris Meddings, and I'm here to tell you about everything I do to support the people of Ukraine and why I'd like you to listen and take part. First is my book, Models for Ukraine Volume 2, which features Small Subjects alumni Calvin Tan and a bunch of other incredibly talented modellers, and all to raise money for humanitarian aid for Ukraine. The full profits of that book go to charity. Also, I'd like to tell you about my other podcast. No, not the Spruikers Union. Models from Ukraine podcast, which is a monthly podcast and features Ukrainian manufacturers and model producers such as Reskit, Dora Wings, Wingsy, and most recently I've interviewed Mini Art for the upcoming show. I also interview modellers about their work and about their support for Ukraine and topics around modelling in general. So if you'd like to do more to help Ukraine, or if you'd just like to listen to a great podcast, check out Models from Ukraine on your podcast app of choice, and please do buy Models for Ukraine Volume 2 from www.insidethearmor.com. Thanks, and back to Small Subjects.
Welcome to Small Subjects, Big Ideas About Miniatures and Modeling. I'm Jim DeRogatis in Chicago.
And I'm Barry Biediger in Salt Lake City.
Barry, I am excited about every episode we record, but I'm especially excited about this one.
Me too.
We are going to chat with Mike Hillary. You said this first. I wholeheartedly agree. One of the best painters in America today.
Yes.
And he has some very illuminating things to say about his painting. And then we are going to chat. We're going to answer a voice message we got that raises a lot of good points. And we're going to chat about my adventures in Beloit.
Yeah, that'll be interesting.
Trigger alert for those who are triggered by such things. The Beloit adventure involves Shep Payne. But I certainly don't want a short mic. We got rolling before we even were ready to say hello to him because Mike was sitting in front of this incredible uniform that we could see behind him on Zoom. And our conversation starts there.
Mm-hmm. That was a great story.
That is actually my grandfather's World War I naval ensign jacket.
Wow.
And I'm sure you can't see it, but there's a little inset picture, and he is on the deck of the USS Olympia.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
So he served on the Arizona. I think that was his first ship. And then he served on the Olympia and made the trip to Murmansk.
Wow.
Which was, I think, the last gasp effort to try and save the whites.
Yeah. I've read about that campaign. That was fascinating.
Yeah, they showed up a little too late.
Yeah, and didn't affect anything.
Nope.
But that's fascinating.
The Olympia is the one in Philadelphia, right?
Yep.
Wow. Cool. Yep. Have you gone
to
see it?
I've been on that ship with him telling me where he was.
Wow.
It was pretty neat.
That's cool.
It was pretty neat. I mean, if you could see all of my, I have figures everywhere. I have an old M1 Garand hanging on my wall here. I'm a history fiend.
Well, it shows. You know what? We just started rolling into this, Barry. I hope you were recording because that was great stuff.
I'm recording.
The formal introduction. We got Mike Hillary zooming in from Connecticut. Barry said this first, Mike, and having judged your work at MFCA, I wholeheartedly concur. One of our favorite painters in America today.
Oh, well, thank you very, very much. I absolutely loved listening to the podcast of you guys talking about my figures with Greg. I actually had it outside on my porch. My wife was listening to it. And she was like, wow, you're kind of getting famous in this whole geeky world. Like, yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, my wife would have said, you guys take this stuff that seriously? No, but we wanted to go to people we respected, because look, if we were judging, mock judging a bronze painter, maybe we would have been able to give him or her some encouraging tips, but also we're complaining about some things, and it's like to go to your work or Christos' work, and it's like there's nothing to complain. This is just, the only problem is what are we going to choose as the masterpiece?
I'm very very humbled to hear you guys say that, because I see stuff, as I'm sure we all do, looking at our own work. And I'm like, oh my God, can't you see that glaring error I made there?
Yeah, but that's the IPMS mindset, where let's look for the things to knock it down.
Right.
And really what I think all the judges in the open system do is look at the things to celebrate.
Yep.
So let's start where we always do, Mike, because the answers are always fascinating. How did you get involved in this weird hobby of ours?
It's funny. I thought maybe you would ask that question. When I was a wee lad, I think I got started like all of us did. I got turned on to armor modeling when I was a kid. Mm. I have a sister who's a bit older than I am, and she was dating a guy who she eventually married, became my brother-in-law. And he was a big diorama maker. Mm. And I can remember going through their apartment as a young kid and just being in absolute awe of these, desert tank scenes. And I think I got in trouble because as a kid, I think I might have taken one of the figures off put it in my pocket.
Don't touch the exhibits.
I know, Andy, never let me live that one down. But I was just fascinated by it. And I think he actually worked at a hobby shop, which was in the town that I grew up in. And, I can remember going into that hobby shop for the first time and just, kid in the candy store. It was the coolest thing ever. And I started building tanks and figures and all that stuff and wanted to get good at it. My whole family is a family of artists. So, I was always getting critiques on painting, and there was, everybody was doing everything art-wise. So there was a lot to draw from. And unfortunately, I think like a lot of people, I probably did that through, high school. Then it kind of just fell off the map.
Yeah.
I was out in Seattle and was in art school at the Art Institute of Seattle, and was driving around, and found this just absolutely phenomenal model shop in Ballard, Washington. Mm-hmm. And walked in, and there were all of these just wonderful figures. And, as a college student, I didn't have a lot of money. I didn't have a lot of room, but I could grab a figure or two. Mm-hmm. And they had a whole bunch of these old Verlinden 120 millimeter figures. It was like, mm-hmm. All right, that's a figure I think I could actually put my time into and see if I could turn it into something. And from that moment, I think I just absolutely fell in love with figure painting.
Was this what, early 90s?
Yeah, early 90s.
You were in Seattle when there was some great music happening.
I saw some great music.
I was guessing, yeah.
Yeah, I saw Soundgarden after Soundgarden. I saw Alice in Chains in a basement. I saw, I was there when Kurt Cobain took his life.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to art school. I was painting houses.
couldn't get a brush out of your hands.
Yeah, I couldn't. I really couldn't. And it was funny too, because I was trying to find work out there. Being from Connecticut, that was probably the farthest away I could get to.
Yeah.
Go experience life for a little while. I initially had gone to school for architecture, thinking that I wanted to be, I was a draftsman in high school, which I think is where my left brain, right brain kind of thing come from. And I had really wanted to be an illustrator. I knew I didn't have the chops to be like a fine artist, but that's not really where my head was at. Professional illustration seemed a little bit more in line with where my creative side was going. And I think figure painting for me became a great expression of that for myself, because it's, you know, it's not a blank canvas, but it's, you know, it's a problem to solve, right? It's there's rules associated with it. Even though I've gotten into the fantasy stuff a little bit more, where you can kind of explode all of those rules, which I find very liberating. But with the historical figures, it's that's where I kind of went to first.
I got to just insert, we must have crossed paths, because I went out to Seattle. It was one of only three interviews Cobain would do when In Utero was coming out, in that house where he eventually took his life. You know, if I'd known there was a hobby shop, I was on that. It was that thing where, you know, you fly into Seattle and you wait till Kurt's in the mood. You know, and it's like, I'm sitting around, I'm going to the freaking Space Needle like a tourist, because I got nothing to do until the call comes. You know, I would have gone to Ballard. It was so weird to have hobby shops that had figures, right? Even in when hobby shops were still a thing, it was always lots of models and then maybe a couple of figures, but not dedicated to it.
They had just the most wonderful collection of figures and all scales. They had basically at that point in time, we are so spoiled now, because at that point in time, basically Verlinden was the game. Mm-hmm. But if you wanted, like, you know, the large scale figures, and they had all of them. And, you know, I remember going in there and being like, okay, you know, today I'm going to get a Napoleonic figure and I need all of these paints. And, it was a great hobby shop.
What did you start out with? Were you acrylics from the beginning? I mean, I guess Vallejo was.
No, I started off with, just because that's what I was given as a kid. I started off with Humbrol and eventually went to the testers, the Model Masters, I think. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I remember I used to hate the sheen that I would get on them, and I would end up like buying four of the same color so that I could just dig the pigment out of the bottom.
Yeah.
So it would dry nice and flat. I don't think I made the shift to acrylics until I came back here and kind of got myself set up back here. My wife, God bless her, basically one day after we had bought this house that we're in now, gone on breaks, like I think a lot of us do. But we bought a house. I knew we weren't going anywhere. And she was like, just set up a freaking bench downstairs.
Yeah, yeah.
Go do something. And I'm in a basement, so I don't want to be breathing all of the fumes. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really when I made the move to acrylics. And it was the Vallejo bottles that kind of got me into the acrylic world. And as I do with everything else, I bought every single paint you could possibly imagine and experimented with all that stuff. And,
you know, there's still a Chicago school, Mike, of painters that came up with Shep Payne. And you know, Shep famously said, all you need is four tubes of oil paint, you know. And, you know, but none of those guys follow that. They all have a million. but. You know, some of them still make fun of us, Joe Burton, our good buddy, in a loving way, of the eyedropper paints, you know. So as your painting evolved, did you find yourself mixing colors more yourself or relying on that range of, you know, every Vallejo paint?
I would say that when I first really dove into it, I was just getting the Vallejo. You know, I know this color from Vallejo is going to work for this. And I was online and looking at all the guides and stuff. And then, yes, eventually I kind of was like, all right, you know what? I need to try my own mixes. Now I've kind of made the move over to the Scale 75 artist lines. Mm-hmm. And they're just lovely.
The tube paints?
Yeah, the tube paints.
Yeah, I've nice. Been, you know, finally feeling like one of the Chicago painters by mixing my own colors from those tubes. They are really, really. But, you know, like anything, it's amazing how certain reds will be super opaque and need 10 coats. And, you know, green, you can just slop on, you know. You know, it's the qualities. These paints have, like, their own personalities, don't they?
Oh, they absolutely do. And sometimes you can mix from manufacturers, and sometimes you absolutely cannot mix from manufacturers. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And you get drastic results. I went through a... You know, I started with the Vallejo. The Vallejo, I think, are pretty decent paints, and they mix up very nicely. And obviously, it's a great place to start for, I would say, their face painting kit. It was a great starter for me to kind of start to think through how I want to put a little bit more tonal variety in figure painting in my faces. Which I really, really focus on. But they're a great place to start. They dried with a sheen. And I remember being at one of the shows, and Dave Youngquist of Last Cavalry was like, you know, if you just put a little bit of this AK Interactive Ultra Matte Varnish in there. And that is one thing I love about the community of figure painters is... Which I do think is a lot different. I've got some buddies who are armor guys, and you know, I feel like when they tell their stories, it's like everyone's got a knife in their hands waiting to stab you. Versus, you know, the figure community, everybody's just out there to help everybody get better, and I've just never met a more supportive community of people who are sharing their tricks and oh, I tried this. What do you think of that? It's really very nice.
What's the first show you went to, Mike?
Oh, so I would say there was a local Amps show here. And I was doing primarily historical figures. I found some Alpine figures at a local model shop here and fell in love with those. Become good friends with Taesung. He's a great guy. And so I brought, I want to say, a half dozen different figures to this primarily armor show. And all of these guys were like, and I was very sheepish about it. I thought my stuff was okay, but I don't know. And all of these figure or armor guys were like flocking to me. How did you do that? How did you do that? And I want to say that was 7-8 years ago. And, you know, I was thinking about this before the podcast. I still feel like such a noob to the larger universe of all of us, you know, all the folks that do this stuff. Cause I didn't go to shows. I didn't really know about shows. Then I went to one show and everyone was like, oh my God, you have to go to this one. You have to go to this one. You have to go to this one. And I don't think it was until I went to the Long Island show. That was probably the first like dedicated figure show I went to, and was just blown away by the work that I saw. And I just want to keep going and going and going. It's just so inspiring to see all the stuff that people put out there. And I take as many pictures as I can and think about what I want to copy and, you know, what I want to try and do as well.
Well, and like you said, that attitude, that welcoming attitude and that willingness to share. Before we stray from art school, you work now as a graphic designer, right?
Yep.
What did you bring from art school to your approach to the hobby? And how does being a graphic designer as a day job inform your painting?
Ooh, that's a great question. I mean, I did all of the color theory stuff, all of the, in art school, all of the different painting techniques. one of the best history classes I had when I was a kid was a modern European history course that was taught all through art from various periods of time. Mm. And I always loved that way of thinking about history and eras and where people are by, I mean, you can tell so much from what the Renaissance people were all about by looking at Renaissance art.
Yeah.
And, you know, and you know, the same with, you know, with postmodernism. And so I'm very much a, from a graphic design standpoint, I think I'm a very clean aesthetic designer. Most of our house is furnished in mid-century modern stuff. I mean, so that's,
I love that look.
That's, we, our entire house is a showroom for that. And so I think the way it informs my painting is I try to be a very technical, you know, I really work on trying to get my techniques and my blends and my color variations as precise as I can. I see some of the stuff that people are doing that are more, I want to say, like a Monet, or like a, you know, there's different pointillism techniques that people are using, and I really like that. It's just not where my head goes yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I feel like I'm trying to anyway, constantly evolve what I'm doing. There's so much to be inspired by just in the community. You go to Putty and Paint, you go to Carol Conniette's books that I pore over and dog ear. There's so much of what I see that I want to try, but I always approach it from my right left brain kind of mashup. Mm-hmm. Of, okay, so how can I do that? And how am I going to get there? And I'd say airbrushing was something that I started to do in art school that I really enjoyed, but never really, I left art school to start my graphic design business. And so now all of my, I've kind of transitioned into digital airbrushing and painting. Mm-hmm. And I've been working with Photoshop since like version 3. I remember when they added layers and I did like a little dance. And there's so much of what I can do in Photoshop that I wish I could do with a paintbrush.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not quite there.
Well,
back in the early 90s, when you're getting started with the figures, how aware were you of the wider miniature world?
Not in the slightest. I mean, I had Shep Payne's books like we all did. Mm-hmm. Every time I could get my hands on one of those Verlinden catalogs, I would pore over those and just look at the pictures. But there weren't really that many people that I knew of who were doing it. And, you know, even from the time I was a kid, you know, my friends all knew that I was into models, and they'd come and you know, they were always kind of awed by the stuff that I did. But I didn't really have any contemporaries who were into the hobby. So it was just kind of my little nerddom. Mm-hmm. And I don't think really I got turned on to the wider world of, hey, there's other people who share this really crazy problem you have, until I went to that first show and seeing all of the work, fascinated by all the dioramas and armor stuff that I saw, which was great. And then getting the feedback on the figures that I showed at that first show was excellent. And I made some good friends and connections. That first show is where I met Taesung.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up and was just so super gracious. And I had painted one of his figures. I think it was the Fallschirmjäger 120 millimeter figure. And it got me an award at that show. And he was like, "You did a great job." And, you know, he was there with his booth. So I'm sure I went home with, you know, a box of all of his stuff, much to my wife's chagrin. And just kind of took off from there. I think we're lucky now because with things like Facebook, which I think we all can agree is both evil and
pluses and minuses. Yeah.
Yes. Has the possibility for good. I think in the model world, it's wonderful because, you know, I've connected with and swapped stories and tips with so many people that I never would have been able to talk to and interact with about this shared passion of ours. It's really cool. And I mean, even, you know, becoming friends with you, Barry, on Facebook before I ever met you at MFCA.
Barry, you notice, Mike, how Barry is everybody's friend. Barry knows everyone in this hobby. I'm like always stunned by that because he's always kind of like, "Oh, I don't know if anybody likes me." I'm like, "What the hell are you talking about, man?"
I don't remember saying that, but
yeah. Well, I paraphrase. All right. Yeah. But before we get away from this, Mike, the interest in architecture, being blown away by brother-in-law Andy's dioramas. You know, the graphic design ability. I mean, man, dioramas? We ever going to see any from you?
I've done a couple of vignettes. Mm. And I have a whole bunch in my head.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to say probably I just need to get off my butt and build them.
Yeah.
I think I'm very much, I'm definitely a figure guy. I just love painting figures. I love the stories that you can tell with figures. It's the patience that I think I lack for multiple figures, multiple figures in a setting. When I have done them and pulled it off, I've been very happy with the result.
Mm-hmm.
I did this last one. I think there were three U.S. airborne figures, Taesung's figures, and brought it, got an award for it, and sold it that same day. So now I don't have anything to inspire me.
It's just my personal passion is always for the storytelling of a diorama.
Yep.
But one of the things that struck me about your displays that I've seen is the breadth of interest. So I can understand if it's just that, like, you know, you want to do Marilyn and then you want to do the warrior Viking lady and then you want to do, you know, and it's like, you know, I can understand that, you know, wanting to jump into all these different things, you know, as opposed to somebody who's done 73,000 hussars, you know.
Well, but I love all the different ranges of figures. I mean, you know, I went through a phase where I was painting all of the Alpine German stuff. Which is great, but, you know, how many times can you paint the same camo smock?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and okay, so this one's going to be the jungle pattern from 1942, and this one's going to be the, and I will say the one time I ever got dinged by the figure equivalent of a rivet counter was somebody who's like, you know, that pattern that you painted on that smock, if you look at the pockets on the smock, that wasn't in production in 1942 when you did your patterns. Like, okay, all right.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Let me just go outside and burn myself.
Man, oh, man.
Yeah. I mean, you do get that every once in a while. And it was not a nasty comment, but it was definitely like, you know, you did that wrong, boy.
Yeah. Yes, and you know what? It's always with the German stuff.
Right. Right. Exactly. Well, yeah, there's definitely a community out there that will tell you exactly when every single pattern came out and what theater. And
yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, I do enjoy doing World War II was really a big source of inspiration for me for a long time. But, you know, the camo gets kind of boring after a while. And then, you know, there's so much life in Napoleonic uniforms. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, I see non-metal metallic stuff. So I'm like, yeah, that looks pretty cool. Let me see what I can do with that. So then I start painting non-metal metallic on armor. And now that's really cool. So let me try and mm-hmm. do that. I think I'm kind of like, still very much a kid. I see something that gets my eye. I'm like, ooh, I want to do that now. And I want to do that now.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
have you tried sculpting?
I have not. I've done some conversions of figures. I would say I've thought a lot about that because the open stuff that I see at the shows just blows me away. I mean, Christos is, I am such a fanboy for him. Mm-hmm. His work is just blows me away every single time I see it. I don't know. You know, being honest with myself, I don't know if I have the patience for it. I have the full-time job, and a lot of the time my painting is really my downtime. So if I can finish up with a client and get down into my bench at 3:30, 4 o'clock, and I've got 2 hours down there, I really enjoy the painting. And so I'm, Barry, I think I sent you a picture of my bench. I've got 15 figures out of 150 from the stash that are primed in various steps of construction. So to take one of those apart or to sculpt my own figure, I've thought about it. Listening to Mike Blank at MFCA and makes me think maybe I could try doing something like that. I mean, I diligently sat there and listened to all of what he was saying about his technique. And again, his work blows me away. Mm-hmm. Looking at John Rosengrant's stuff, it's just phenomenal. As a painter, I almost feel like all these guys are doing all of these great figures. I should probably just paint theirs, shouldn't I?
Mike, the satisfaction of having a figure, even if it's a bronze level figure in open, right? That's the only one there, right?
Yes.
You know, I'm not at that level of a Christos or a Rosengrant, Lord knows, you know, but it's like, hey, I got this. Nobody else has this.
Yeah,
there's no requirement that you sculpt figures, though. I mean, that's not what you want to do. That's not what you want to do.
I've definitely been toying with it a lot more recently, and again, I think going to shows is just such a source of inspiration. Mm. Seeing all the stuff that's out there, it definitely does make me think about, okay, well, what could I do? What would be something that I'd want to do?
So, you know, being enmeshed in the digital world for the graphic design business, mastering Photoshop, you got to have an eye toward AI and design and, digital printing. Any insights into how that may impact our hobby?
I think the explosion of digital printing and 3D modeling has just made everything so much more doable and realizable, I think, from that kind of digital world to something that you can hold in your hand and paint. I'm sure that as long as AI doesn't take us all over and kill us. You can use AI.
There is that danger, yeah. When one of the guys who runs the biggest company in it is telling Congress, please regulate me.
But how cool would it be to be able to, and I'm sure this is not that far off, to be able to use AI to generate a 3D sculpt, to then take that from a 3D environment, layer it with all of the textures and things that you need to do to make a really good 3D model, and then have that come out into a 3D printer to where somebody like me can paint it. I'm sure we're not that far away from that. I work with a couple of different 3D animators and designers when I need characters or things that I'm working into a client video or something like that. Mm. And it's pretty amazing what's out there already in terms of all the different bits and pieces that you can just grab, rather than, you know, I can remember not that long ago in the digital world, you know, you'd have to hire a model maker to build you a model of whatever it is you were trying to represent in a client request. Mm. And now there's just a library of elements out there, and the tool set, the digital tool set to manipulate them, to skin them, to animate them is just so much more prevalent and easy to acquire. It's amazing. The technology revolution, which I think we do see in our hobby, I've kind of watched and grown up with in my day job. You know, I do client videos on my MacBook Pro laptop that I used to, back in the day, I would have had to go into New York City and rent a room for like $350
an hour,
you know, and hire an editor. And now I'm doing it all on my laptop in my house.
But, you know, the striking thing cool. is that, you know, working all day in this digital realm on this high end stuff and really knowing that, and then you're eager to go to the basement and get the, yes. you know, get the Series 7 in your hand,
yes, yeah.
which is still physical.
Which is still physical. And it's the only, you know, it's the only actual brush stuff that I get to do anymore. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I used to love, I had a great experience with the Seattle Art Institute. They were great teachers. I loved my studio time there. I loved the camaraderie of being in art school and sharing a room with other artists and, you know, seeing what everybody was coming up with. You know, I live in a very creative environment. It's great. And I mean, I will say all the time, it beats working for a living, right?
Sure.
I get to play on a computer all the time. It's awesome. But I definitely cherish the time downstairs with an actual paintbrush and a palette. And
yeah.
It's, you know, it's my Zen time. It's great.
There does actually seem to be a need for, at least so far in human history, to work with our hands.
Absolutely.
Still there.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So Mike,
who knows in 10 years if we'll still have that. But.
Oh, I think I so. Hope
we,
you know,
I hope.
You can play a drum machine, Barry. You can program a drum machine, but sitting behind the drums or picking up that guitar, right? Mm-hmm. It's still a physical play. Like, look. We can have virtual sex, right? It ain't the same as being in a room with someone you love, right? That's how I always put it when I'm trying to drive that point home to the students. All right, so you say you feel like a newbie. I always feel the same way, Mike. I think Barry does too, despite being a grandmaster wizard. You know, what advice would you give to the kid who's, you know, interested in painting those Warhammer figures and wants to take the next step as a painter? What would you say to them?
You know, it's funny. The armor guys ask me that all the time. What do I do? What do I do?
They seem to think it's like this inscrutable mystery. We've talked to many of those guys, Barry and I.
It's really not that tough, guys. Honestly, I think the biggest improvement that I went through, that I experienced, was really embracing busts. Mm-hmm. You know, as a figure painter and as somebody who really is into illustrating human form, right? The detail afforded by a large-scale bust, painting a face, and getting that skill, I think, is the place to start. Mm. So I have friends who ask me all the time, and I just tell them, get yourself a bust. Get yourself a bust. Work on skin tones, work on faces. The rest of the stuff, I mean, not to belittle uniform details and all, I mean, there's so many nuances and rabbit holes and things that you can focus on, which is why I think we all love it so much. I mean, the details are what drive each figure and make each figure different. But I think they all start with the face. And I think even if you're a mediocre painter, but you can feel good about the face that you paint mm-hmm. on a large scale bust, mm-hmm. it will drive you then to complete the rest of the figure and do a great job.
I think you're right. There's no gold level painters who can't do faces so well. It all starts yeah. with the face.
And that's what people, you know, people come up to me all the time. And that's what they're asking me for. Mm. Usually it's not, you know, maybe some of my non-metal metallic stuff, people are asking about how you do that, but it's skin tones, eyes, expressions, you know, what are you using? How are you doing it? And, I mean, I try and give as much information as I can to everybody who I see at the shows. And on Facebook. I mean, I have a lot of people ask me questions on Facebook, and I'm overjoyed to get on direct chats with people. I mean, you know, any tips that I can offer, I'm happy to.
That's great. So what do you think it is that's so difficult to, it's been very hard for me to talk to modelers, plastic modelers who want to get into figures and try to get them just started. And it seems like the first step is the most difficult. They're afraid of it.
Yeah.
And they're so hung up on how do I blend perfectly? Like that, yeah. Don't worry about that yet, I always say. But they,
right.
it seems to be just a completely different mindset.
Well, and I think it's tough too, because the 1/35th scale figures I find to be some of the most daunting figures to do, right? Mm. I always find them to be kind of one of the toughest figures to do because the scale is just so small. Mm-hmm. I think the armor modelers, they are so detail oriented and so fixated on, you know, all the photo etch stuff. And I mean, I think it's great. I'm in awe of that level of detail, but I think it's a different mindset with mm-hmm. figure painting. And I think it's tough sometimes for them to separate themselves from that level of micro detail to, you know, okay, let me just try this figure. And that's why I think, you know, a larger scale figure or bust is a good place to start, because I think you can work on things like the blends on a larger canvas, basically, and then figure out how to reduce that for them to paint their figures to go on their tanks and stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And even if they're blowing out the instruction sheet by adding photo etch and stuff, right? There's still an instruction sheet, you know.
Yes.
And Shep's tutorial back in the book, you know, a lot of the stuff Marion Ball does, right? There's great yep. tutorials out there, but you still got to think more like an artist, you know.
Yes.
And it's like you're not following the recipe, you're not following the instructions. At some point, right. you're going to have to take a leap.
Yeah. No. And the build on the figure is a relatively simple process, right? You clean up the parts, you put it together. I mean, I think I was downstairs for an hour and a half, and I think I had two figures all cleaned up and ready to prime. Mm-hmm. So, and if you're a modeler, I think that's like blows your mind, right? Because now you're like, oh, now what do I do?
Right, right.
So, but I mean, I do think, you know, I there are some pretty simple procedural steps you can go through that I always try and tell people. You know, I, even though I'm using the Scale 75 Artist acrylics, prime your stuff with, I use a Mr. Surfacer 1000, nice clean gray. I airbrush a base coat of skin tone, the Scale 75 bottle, because it's, as you probably have experienced, sometimes the artist acrylics don't cover as well on the first pass. Mm-hmm. And then honestly, even just if you get the artist acrylic skin tone set, and within each one of those, there's a little guide, and it's not a bad guide to start with. And yeah. So a lot of the times I'll tell guys that I know who are armor people, I'm like, look, follow, here's some instructions. I know you need instructions. Follow these instructions.
Right.
And, you know, here's the brushes you're going to need. You know, use some mineral water and just go for it. And I think it's enough. I've got a couple of buddies who I've kind of talked through the process, and they're now, one of them brought a figure and competed at MFCA and got a silver medal for it. Damn. So, you know, and he's an armor guy who I think was terrified of figures and busts, and he listened to me. He got a bust, and he's doing great work. He's doing great work.
Well, that's the spirit we were bringing up sculpting to you.
Okay.
You know, yeah. And if you never do it, you know, there's some people who just love to paint, you know, and, but it's just, I'd love to see what else you're capable of.
Yeah. You and me both, man.
I hear you. I never enough I have no time. Idea. I know. Barry and I said, why can't we be retired? Like half our friends in the hobby, you know?
Oh man. If I could, I would be down there all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's definitely some things that I think I would be subjects that I'd be interested in doing. And I see one figure and I'm like, oh, well, if I had these other two, I Life Miniatures put out a new version of Captain Miller from Saving Private Ryan.
I saw that. Yeah.
Which was just such a great figure. And there's a BAR gunner that I think is another one. So I, you know, in terms of your vignette question, I definitely have that in my head. Could I sculpt a wounded, you know, Corporal Wade underneath the radar mast there, you know, because that's kind of what I have in my head. Could probably sculpt a wounded guy, right? I mean, just I could do
put
that.
Put bandages on whatever isn't coming
out right. What could go wrong? So, I mean, those are the kinds of things that I like that movie. I remember seeing that movie and was just like, oh my God, this is the best thing ever. And so well acted and such an inspiration. I've painted, I want to say, like three different versions of Tom Hanks as Captain Miller and the friends. Now I've got a full figure of him. So that's definitely a vignette that I have in my head.
All right.
Very cool.
Well, Mike, it's a pleasure chatting, and I hope we get to hang at the next show.
Absolutely. I keep on getting told that I have to go to the Chicago show. So I think I'm going to make an attempt this year, you know, getting stuff ready for the Long Island show. You know, Greg DeFranco has just been such a great inspiration. Love talking to him. So I really enjoy that show as well. I mean, eventually I'd love to get to Europe with one of, you know, for some of this stuff. But
Expo, the next World Expo is taking place in Versailles in the summer of 2025.
That sounds like a place I should probably be.
And it's not far. It's not far from Paris. And so, you know, 5 or 6 days with the wife in Paris, the greatest city in the world, before going to the model show in Versailles, which is, you know, that's where we're going. That Barry and I are like saving our trip. We're saving our pennies, brother.
All right. All right. Well, I definitely definitely plan on being at the Chicago show this year. I keep getting grief when I don't go. And I've got a couple people who are, if you go, I'm going to buy these figures. So at least I can pay.
Oh, there you go. There you go.
Pay for some of my trip, which is great.
Well, Chicago is a friendly show. And it's one, obviously, Barry and I are really proud of. So, And, you know, there's going to be the other half of this episode. There's going to be some Shep Payne dioramas that have not been seen by anybody since he made them.
Wow. Yeah. It was pretty cool at MFCA seeing the Lady Down.
Yeah.
Great stuff.
Well, the only
great
thing that's going to limit how many of the boxes are there is how many Joe and I can fit in a car. And Barry, you may have to Uber out to Schaumburg.
That's fine. You know, it's probably safer too, right?
Or you could always hold a box or two on your lap. Yeah. Not the night watch, though. Sure. I think it would hurt you physically.
Oh, yeah.
So you'll hear us talk about the rest of that, Mike.
All right. Well, that's all. I mean, those. I think everybody in this community just draws so much inspiration and awe from that work.
Yeah, it's true. And then you see it, you know, much less get to take it apart like I've been doing and putting it back together. It's stunning. And but you know, hey, Shep always said it's about the storytelling first and foremost. Yep. And I do love what you're doing with the single figures. I mean, that Marilyn bust. You know, it was telling a story. I mean, you know, it, you know, damn, you're good.
Thank you very much.
And a pleasant guy to hang out with. Thank you so much.
I really appreciate it.
Mike Hillary.
Well, thanks a lot, Mike.
Oh, my pleasure, guys.
Mike Hillary. I think, Barry, he qualifies as a small subject's great guy to
choose
your. He does.
He is a great guy. Yeah.
That is your trademark term.
Yeah, right.
Mike Hillary, a great guy, a fantastic painter. And we got, from another great guy, we got a really thought-provoking message on our voicemail system on Telby. We always encourage people to call in with questions or comments. Let's play what David Bridges asked us.
Hi, guys. This is David Bridges. I just wanted to say thanks for you guys doing such a wonderful podcast. I enjoy listening to every episode. Just hearing all the great stories about Shepard Payne and interviews with so many great modelers. I've really just enjoyed it and want to thank you guys for your efforts. But I also have a question for you. I went to my first model contest in 1997 when I was in high school. And since then, I've been to quite a few IPMS shows from the local all the way up to many nationals. I've been to a lot of AMP shows and do a lot with their judging cadre, and I finally got to attend my first World Model Expo in Eindhoven this last year, which was really wonderful. I really enjoyed it a lot. And my question to you guys is, do you think or should IPMS USA and maybe some of the other international branches evolve and change from the way they do business now? And do you even think that's possible for them or even likely that they will change? Or do you think that it's time for a completely new and more modern modeling society to come up in parallel to all the other organizations that are already out there? To me, it seems like our modeling world has changed, and with social media and people's change in tastes and genres as far as how and what they build, and even bringing new modelers into the hobby and seeing who's out there, I wonder sometimes if there's not an opening or a space for something completely new. And I was wondering what you guys think about the possibility of the current organizations changing to meet the changing world, or if it's time for something new. Thanks again, guys, for your great podcast, and I'll see you later. Bye.
All right, David Bridges, if I'm summing that up, is it time for another organization besides IPMS?
Yeah, I think that's a fair summation. In a lot of ways, we already have a new organization, and that's social media.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And that's, I mean, people are, I think people are more commonly participating on Facebook and Instagram, for example, than they are in IPMS club meetings, which often tend to be at least half about business and, you know, all this crap about voting and stuff. So anyway.
Yeah, no, social media is a great tool to bring together people with a passion for every end of this hobby that you can name, painting and sculpting and dioramas and fantasy and historical. You know, what social media doesn't do, Barry, is give you a chance to see the work in person. Right. And that's an important
part of the hobby. Yeah.
Oh, it is. And to socialize in person and have those conversations like the ones we had with Mike Hillary before we shared him with the rest of our listening audience, right?
Yeah.
You know, this comes, David, in the context of the editorial by the current president of IPMS in the most recent IPMS USA Journal. Mm-hmm. Why do I get this, Barry? I get the magazine, which I'm not going to get anymore since I'm not renewing my membership, because you and I went to IPMS Nats in Omaha last year. That was Small Subjects episode 35. And we both paid nearly $100 to exhibit our work.
It wasn't episode 35.
So. Oh, it wasn't?
No. You want me what to look it up? Which one?
Yeah, I thought I looked it up before.
35 was the last one we did.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, I didn't.
Episode 25. Episode 25. Right. 25. We came back last August from IPMS. We recorded our thoughts about it and a great interview with one of the vice presidents, John Bonanni, who is another Small Subjects great guy. Mm-hmm. All right. We both paid nearly $100. You had to join IPMS to exhibit your work, and you had to pay an exhibitor's fee. And we did. And we both came home with awards. Okay, big deal. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The most important part of the show was seeing other artists' work and enjoying the company of our good friends, right?
Well, it was the main reason for going, right?
That was the main reason we went. It's the only reason we went. And we figured if we're going, we'll bring something, we'll show it, okay?
Yeah.
And we got awards. The current editorial by David Lockhart has two very problematic passages. Mm-hmm. One is evidence of a certain hubris that the International Plastic Modeling Society has. He writes, "Would plastic modeling be as prolific as it is without IPMS USA? No. Would we have a national convention without IPMS USA? No. Would there be local shows without IPMS USA? No." Bull, Mr. Lockhart. Have you heard of MMSI? Have you heard of MFCA? Have you heard of AMPS? Have you heard of the Atlanta Figure Modeling Society and the Long Island Figure Modeling Society, the many garage kit societies, the fantasy groups, much less, let's go around the world, the dozens and dozens of shows and clubs that happen around the world. Mm-hmm. To think that IPMS is the only club and exhibit, you know, exhibition holder in this world is just is hubristic, as I said, and close-minded and idiotic, frankly. Yeah. Even more troublesome, Barry, Lockhart made the point that people who come and exhibit their work at shows and win awards but don't do anything else in the organization are, and I quote, freeloaders.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Freeloaders. Yeah. Now, how you're a freeloader when you paid almost $100 to exhibit your work at the Nationals, I don't know. That's a lot of money to be freeloading. Right. You know, what the hell was this guy? You understand the IPMS mindset more than I do. And it is not the majority of the organization. When we talked to John Bonanni after our trip to Nats last year, episode 25, thank you for correcting me, John is trying to foment a revolution. This goes back to David Bridges' question. And John said that the polls they have taken of the IPMS membership, two things are obvious. Number one, there is a desire to move away from that first, second, third place narrow category way of judging, and number two, that there is a willingness to welcome fantasy figures and Gundam figures and to broaden the horizons behind airplanes on a wooden base.
Yeah, yeah, because that's where things are going and have gone for a long time.
For a very long time.
They refuse to keep up with the times. And I mean, it reminds me of when I first started getting involved with IPMS in my local club. And I only go to those meetings when I want to hang out with friends. I mean, that's what I want to go for. I think I let my membership lapse last year, but I do pay my local my local dues and go to the meetings and hang out with my friends. But early on, there was this grudging acceptance of armor modelers. And it was, oh, well, I guess we'll let you participate. We'll let you show up, but we're really more of an airplane society. And figure people were, come on, we didn't even exist.
And car? Car modelers?
I've had car modelers, yeah, and let's not even talk about them. But the, I mean, I've been told multiple times that figures are not even modeling, so why are you even here? There's still a core, the old school core of IPMS that is all about this is filling seams and making landing gear straight on airplanes, and that's what we're about.
Rivet counting. Yeah.
Rivet counting, I hate that because...
I know, I'm sorry. I don't want to trigger you on that.
There's nothing wrong with rivet counting. And I understand the way Mike was meaning it in the interview, but rivet counters play an important part.
All right. But the point is, but it's not just about airplanes.
And it's not rivet counting. That's the whole thing. So you can go to an IPMS competition... And I've seen this happen a lot of times. It's funny because you can go in and put an airplane into the detail category and win, right? Because you're competing. You're actually going up against your fellow modeler to see who wins.
Who's better, quote unquote.
Yes. You can win that category by having straighter landing gear and better filled seams. Even if that other person is more accurate, which you can't really include accuracy, and I understand why you can't. And if that other modeler has done a far better job painting and finishing and weathering.
Yeah.
Right? As long as you've done things cleanly, that's all that matters. And that's fine. That's how a lot of them want to do it. Sure. Fine. But is that really worthy of more than just a couple extra categories? Let's have a clean builds category. I don't know.
Well, look, the point is that the categories, the idea of competing, the idea that going to the show and paying to enter your work, is makes you a freeloader if you're not doing any more than that. Look, MMSI membership is free, and you get 4 issues a year of our electronic club journal. If you're an old school person who isn't online, you can pay a little extra and get it in print. MFCA membership is free, and there's a free journal there. None of the other clubs look on people as freeloaders if they're coming to the show. They're doing two things. They're supporting the show with an entrance fee, or if they're exhibiting, they're paying an exhibitor's fee, and they're going to the vendors. And right. Keeping the vendors coming to the show keeps them healthy and doing business and makes the shows possible.
Yes.
You know, Lockhart subsequently apologized in a rather mealy-mouthed way, I think, for using the term freeloaders. But that hubris was still there. It always is there with IPMS. There would be no modeling without this organization. It's nonsense. We just named a dozen other organizations. And, this notion that IPMS is needed because shows need insurance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now, that's what you hear a lot. That's one of their main arguments.
Well, let me explain that. Many venues, whether they're hosting a juried exhibition like MMSI or a wedding in big cities, require the organizers of the event to get what's called in the field slip and fall insurance, right?
Yeah.
grandma comes to the wedding and breaks her leg. Grandpa, hurts himself at the MMSI show. You know, the hotel doesn't want to be liable. They don't want to be sued. And they're going to sue the organization sponsoring this event, perhaps. You get slip and fall insurance. Some venues require it. Some venues don't. It's not rocket science. Any organization can apply for it, whether it's the Jones family holding a wedding or the MMSI is an incorporated nonprofit organization, arts education organization. Most clubs are. It's not very difficult to do that and then to apply for insurance if it's needed. You know, the idea that only the IPMS can sponsor shows because only the IPMS can provide insurance is just nonsense.
Well, I mean, you could have even a national organization that is a pool of resources to get insurance at shows. I guess maybe they could change their name to the insurance provider for modeling shows.
Show insurance provider incorporated.
IPMS, insurance provider for modeling shows, right?
Oh, that was good. They wouldn't even have to change their logo.
No, it would save on design costs because it's just, yeah. IPMS.
Insurance provider for modeling shows.
It's just if that's the main reason for your organization's existence, that's just it's kind of sad.
It's sad and it's sorry.
I think the idea, and I've seen this over and over, I've seen this attitude, the idea that people who are coming to your show, participating, spending money to enter, and bringing models that are, based on what he said, good enough to win awards. And so therefore you're making your show a better show, that those people are somehow freeloading is just beyond me. And I know this has been discussed a lot online, but I don't think he answered it well enough. I don't think that has been discussed enough, because that it is a pervasive attitude in IPMS that we are here and modeling doesn't exist without us. It's really kind of bizarre.
It's a pervasive attitude in part of IPMS. When we talk to
IPMS.
John Bonanni, who's a vice president, he says that polls of the organization show that two things. People want to move away from the 1-2-3 competition aspect toward the open system, and that people are more than happy to have Gundam and robots and fantasy and figures and dioramas. There's a broader open-mindedness in the organization than its current executives, some of its current executives seem to embrace. They want to, hey, the organization is going to die unless it changes. That's true of any organization that isn't open-minded and open to change. And what's more, his point about freeloading, if you need help, if you need computer back-end help, if you need setting up tables help, ask. Yeah. Rather than saying, hey, nobody's helping, well, you haven't asked for help.
Yeah, actually make it clear what you need. Right?
Hey, when we worked together on World Expo 2017, the committee, most of the people from Chicago put it on, we had help from every club in America. People were all lending us their elbow grease, their technical expertise. You and me and Penny Meyer and Andy Golden spent hours, Joan, your wife, making the PowerPoint for the presentation, the awards. You know, we had the Atlanta Club helping us taking exhibitor fees and visitor fees. I mean, the hobby I've always found is full of people who are willing to help make these shows happen. And I think it's more of a testament to the standoffishness and pride of IPMS than it is freeloading, quote unquote, exhibitors or visitors.
I agree.
But you're going to Texas anyway this year. You're going to go to IPMS Nats again. I'm never going to go again.
Because, they're going to provide insurance. So how could I resist that?
Well, here's when I'll go. If John Bonanni becomes president and gets to write columns.
Yeah, that's true. But it's good to hang out with friends and see some great models by a lot of freeloaders.
All right. Well, if you missed all of that online discussion, we just tried to encapsulate it. Let's talk about something that's much more exciting, Barry.
Yes. I don't know where to go with that.
Let's go to Beloit.
Yeah, let's go to Beloit.
I was setting you up for a segue.
I know.
There.
I didn't know what this. I know exactly.
That's
what we're
okay.
Talking
That's
about.
All right. You're doing fine, brother. We're going to Beloit. Why are we going to Beloit, Wisconsin, which is just over the border from Rockford, Illinois? Let me give you a little history lesson first. There was a wonderful, one of the nicest people I've ever met in the hobby, old gent named Ralph Kebbeman, Kebby to his friends. Kebby had at some point invented some widget for an industrial machine, and nothing in that industry, those machines couldn't work without his widget, and he made a lot of money. Kebby invested it in his passion. Beautiful, sprawling ranch house in Rockford, and the entire first floor was full of his wife's wonderful impressionistic art, and Kebby had the basement. When I say sprawling, Barry, I'm talking nearly three quarters of a city block. Okay? Mm-hmm. This industrial space under his home. And Ralph Kebbeman had two passions in the miniatures world: miniature guns. He wrote a book about his collection of these incredibly precise and beautiful miniature guns, many of them working, and dioramas. Mm-hmm. Kebbeman bought several of those massive super dioramas, is what the Verlinden magazines used to call them,
right,
by Bob Letterman and Louis Pruneau, two late great modelers from that world. Some of these super dioramas, the attack on Pearl Harbor, the Third Army rolling through to liberate a French town, the railroad guns that were so massive in World War II, in 1/35th scale. Some of these dioramas, Barry, were the size of two or three pool tables laid end to end. You know, incredible work. And that was a big chunk of the basement. But then there was a very special room that Ralph had displayed in the walls, the world's biggest collection of box dioramas of this kind of high-end miniature art. He owned 11 of Shep Payne's box dioramas, and the work of Peter Twist, Spencer Van Gulik, some other diorama makers, Philip Stearns, key founding figure of the hobby. Joe Burton had been talking about him doing the first book that elevated painting toy soldiers to painting fine art miniatures. I got to go out and meet Ralph when I was writing my book about Shep's work and life. We spent hours together talking about his passions and touring his basement. I think Shep and I also went out to Rockford another time and just had lunch with Ralph. For years, for decades, Ralph was a dedicated member of the MMSI, would drive in from Rockford to go to the club meetings, to go to the show, would bid on everything at the auction to lend his money to keep the club going. Ralph was, you know, a mere 95 or so when I interviewed him, and he passed several years ago. We were under the impression that his son Richard, who must be in his late 70s, was going to try to keep Ralph's incredible collection together as a museum, right? Mm-hmm. Either in the home or somewhere else in the Rockford area. And suddenly, I was taping my other podcast. I think we had just interviewed Jason Isbell, so it was an important taping for us. Mm-hmm. I got this email from a fine fellow who lives just across the border in Illinois from Beloit. Matt Mathis was telling me, do you know there's a bunch of Shep box dioramas going up for auction at this place I monitor, Beloit Auction and Realty. Big sprawling place in Beloit. Usually, Barry, they sell or they auction off muscle cars and, like, you know, 70s VW campers and
that's
jewelry.
Some cool classic cars.
Cool classic cars, and there's jewelry and odd stuff. But there was also Ralph Kebbeman's basement. Much of it, some of it not yet being auctioned off, but the Pruneau and Letterman super dioramas, and what's more, the all the Shep boxes. So I immediately called Joe Burton, and Joe knows a lot about the auction world. Mm-hmm. That episode with him, what a fascinating guy, and we only scratched the surface, right? Joe has, over the years, bid on militaria, medals. He loves to collect paper, you know? Every once in a while, he'll say, here, look at this, right? And it's like Napoleon's orders to Davout in the field, in the middle of one of the campaigns, signed by the emperor, you know? Yeah. Joe's got it. Joe's got medals. He's got 11 camel saddles, as he told us. He's got items, you know, daggers and headdresses worn by Lawrence of Arabia.
Yeah.
Joe knows auctions. Joe knows auctions so well. His wife, Gloria Groom, is the curator of European art at the Art Institute. A week before we heard about this auction, the Art Institute was planning to bid on the work of a Dutch painter some $8 million, right? And when you're at that level, Christie's actually flew the painting in for one day so everybody at the Art Institute of Chicago could look at it. Then they flew it back to New York to hold the auction, right?
That's so they like were eBay, huh?
As not like eBay. So Joe was advising them how to do this. They were freaking out at the Art Institute. They were afraid they were going to not get the painting. And Joe was like, you know, we're going to get it. We got a good plan here, right? And they got it. So Joe said, we're going to come up with a plan. We're going to try to rescue these dioramas by Shep that mean so much to all of us, that mean so much to the hobby. They're all in need of repair. All of the lights had burned out. We went out to Beloit, me and Joe and his brother Dave, and we checked out all the dioramas. They're in good shape, it seemed, except for the light being out. So Joe sprung into action, and we had a plan. And he brought in me and you and Nick Infield and Dennis Levy. We've interviewed them both. Box dioramas makers, and Daryl Audette, a collector of Shep stuff and a fine box diorama maker himself. He had two pieces in Ralph's collection. Yeah. And we said, look, let's not work against each other. Let's not bid against each other.
And these are people that Joe knew were, you know, had personal connection to these boxes.
Personal connections to the boxes and to Shep.
Yeah.
You know, and what's more, a fairly rare skill, had the ability to repair these boxes, make the repairs that were necessary to bring them back to life and share them with other people. Mm-hmm. This was not a secret cabal or plot. This was
by a long shot. Yeah.
Not by a long shot. This was saying, Daryl, if the Swamp Ogre is one that you really want, we won't bid on that. We're going to bid on these others instead. You know, Joe figuring that each of those dioramas was worth at minimum $3,000 for the smallest and double or triple that for bigger pieces. We just didn't want to bid against each other. Nevertheless, somebody accused us of doing that.
Yeah, which is ridiculous.
Being a cabal.
Which is ridiculous because it was a group of friends getting together, like you said, and just saying, hey, I'm not going to compete against you because it's against our interest to do that.
Right, right. Yeah. We wanted to bring these dioramas back to life and make them available, hopefully for a serious gallery showing we're trying to pull together for next year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Joe was on vacation in Greece, Barry, and he got up at 3:30 in the morning on the island of Crete and put in bids for many of us. We had pledged to go up to X amount on these. And talk about an exciting evening for us, crack of dawn for Joe. We were successful in getting our hands on some of these key pieces. One open diorama, Shep's parrot gun in 1/10 scale. And Joe also got the In the Turret of the Monitor box, the Night Watch, the Militia Company of Friends, Bannincock, where Shep realized in 3D Rembrandt's famous painting. Joe got Brady's Photographic Gallery and A King of Shreds and Patches, the Hamlet's Father's Ghost, which hopefully is going to wind up in your hands.
Yeah.
I am honored beyond honored to have the Legend of Sleepy Hollow and A Stillness at Appomattox, and Daryl Audette got the Swamp Ogre, the Merrimack, and the Slave Trade. another Chicago guy, Jerry Hutter, wound up with Mr. Christian, the bounty scene. And Yorktown, we don't know. We were outbid on Yorktown. Don't know who got that, but we're trying to make contact because, again, we'd like to do a gallery show with all these pieces. This was the single biggest collection of Shep boxes. There are others that individual collectors have. I've talked in the past about repairing the Victory, the gun deck of the Victory, first for Dan Bird and now for Bill Neustadt. There goes my mad money for a long time,
right?
Maybe forever. Right. And Joe's older, so he had more mad money. Daryl actually went to his credit union, but there was never going to be another opportunity to bring these pieces home, so to speak.
No, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
So, I have so far repaired, restored, lovingly, the Night Watch, like 3 dozen figures and a dog. I mean, the figures mm-hmm. were in perfect shape. Every light had burned out. I've repaired the turret of the Monitor. I've repaired Sleepy Hollow. It's on mm-hmm. my shelf right now. Mm-hmm. I'm working on Appomattox now, Barry. Mm-hmm. I'm going to save Hamlet's Father's Ghost for you. Mm, I know you really want to bring that back to life.
I do.
Daryl doesn't have his boxes yet, but Joe's bringing Brady over tomorrow. When we say the lights were gone, Shep had used automotive lights. That's what mm-hmm. was available. You know, so the Monitor, his first real box after a little Hysterex one he did, was 1976.
Mm-hmm. Right.
All right. So he's using automotive bulbs. And later, as he got fancier, he's using grain of wheat or grain of rice bulbs from the model railroad world.
Back in the 70s and 80s, that the automotive bulbs were incandescent bulbs.
Incandescent.
You can't find them anymore. They would burn out after a while, and they produced a lot of heat, too.
A lot of heat. The Monitor, he used two fluorescent fixtures, but he was so worried about the heat, he had coated the entire interior of the box with aluminum foil.
Wow.
And he'd put in two little, like, refrigerator vents in the back of the box.
Yikes, yeah. Not even a concern with LEDs.
No, LEDs weren't available, you know, then. He would certainly have embraced that technology if they were. And these boxes used these Radio Shack transformers, all open and exposed in their wiring, about the size of a softball and maybe about 5 pounds in weight.
Yeah.
My repairs have involved, taking the tray out, the inner scene, and the reveal, and trying as closely as possible. With the Night Watch, there were 14 brass tube spotlights, Barry.
Mm. Wow.
All of
14.
Them incandescent. 14. and I obviously wanted the light to go where Shep wanted the light to go,
right,
which he was trying to duplicate what Rembrandt had done. And, I kept the tubes where they were, took the burned out incandescents out. He didn't have dimmers on that one, but on some of the others he did, and they were these big ungainly rheostats. I've seen them in Peter Twist's box too, and they began to leach this white toxic kind of flaky stuff. It's the metal was literally disintegrating, and the same with some of the incandescent fixtures. Bad news. We heard that Mr. Christian, the transformer, actually sparked and caught fire at one point. I told Jerry the first thing to do is get rid of that transformer right away. You know, throw it away. So I've been taking out these transformers and the old wiring and cleaning up the scene, a little bit of lead rod on a few cannonballs in the Monitor. And Joe taught me how to fix that. You brush it all off and you reprime with enamel and repaint with enamel. The enamel giving a better coating to keep the lead rod away. In some cases, I've had to do a little woodwork. The boxes had, like, you know, wood is a living organic material. A little bit of sanding necessary to get the tray back in on Appomattox. But I'm replacing all the lights with LEDs, putting modern 12-volt transformers in, dimmers, modern dimmers. You need a special dimmer for most LEDs, you know, especially if they're colored. Trying to replicate what he did with theatrical gels. I've never had more fun. You know, doing this work, bringing these masterpieces back to life, and then delivering them to Joe, the ones that he owns, and getting that wow. You know, and I swear I've felt closer to Shep than at any point since we did the book together. I swear, Barry, those boxes, I said this the other day, and Carmel was scoffing at me when I told you. I'm like, I got my head inside these boxes, you know, pulling out rotten wiring. They smell like Shep's house.
Yeah.
The boxes still smell. You know that unique smell of his kitchen dining room area?
Yeah.
You know, because he'd make like a fancy French dish like coq au vin that he would eat for a week, and the house would smell like that. These boxes smell like Shep's house.
Yeah. Now, I can't wait to work on the Hamlet box. I'm excited.
Well, you know, there's this moment of trepidation where, all right, I got to take this fixture out. I'm going to cut these wires. And you're just like, you know, I mean, imagine the artists, the restoration experts who spent a decade restoring The Last Supper by Da Vinci, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I saw a documentary on that work, you know, and the paint is literally crumbling off the wall of that monastery in Milan. And, you know, I mean, you want to preserve everything you can. On the other hand, you got to take this off or it's only going to spread, you know. So, right. Yeah, you know, you're clipping the wire, but you're making triple sure before you do that it's not one you're going to need. And I don't want to take that brass tube off because he had it there for a reason. It was pointing the spotlight. Oh, look at that. That spotlight lands on the dog.
Well, and Joe brought up another interesting that, when we're restoring these, we need to do it in a way to make it a little easier for future people to restore them if needed. Of course, with the LEDs, they're lasting tens of thousands of hours. So it's not quite the same thing, but
the LEDs I use are guaranteed for 100,000 hours, and I've also seen the number 150,000 hours. Mm-hmm. You know, to put them in the wall, Ralph had taken out the on-off switch and controlled his display room with just, you know, master wall switch. So I'm putting the on-off switches back, and it's probably not a good idea to leave them on 24/7 for months at a time.
Right.
Everything will burn out eventually. But years ago, Shep was looking inside one of my boxes, and I'm not nearly as neat and precise as you are, but I try to be as neat and precise as I can be, often securing the wires with industrial strength Velcro. And Shep was always stingy with a compliment, right? You know, he could be. And he looked at that. He said, "Damn, I wish I'd thought of that. That's a great idea." I was like, okay. Yeah. So, you know, the lights are mostly secured in place now, the new LEDs with Velcro, so that somebody in the future, 50 years from now, if they need to, can take them out and slip a new one in.
Yeah.
And if there's a new technology at that point, you know Shep would have loved working with LEDs because it would have enabled not to have to worry about the heat in the boxes and bulbs burning out as quickly. And but Joe thinks like an art conservator, doesn't he?
Yeah. And it made me think of some of my boxes, because one of the things that comes along with the convenience of the LEDs is you can also install them in ways that are pretty permanent. And so I do have a couple that would take some work, but at least I glued them in place with white glue that can be removed.
Right.
If I'd used epoxy, wow, that would have been, you know, you could not have restored that in 30 years. No, when, well, but no, nobody's going to care about it in 30 years.
When I was repairing the Peter Twist box, Joan of Arc, that Joe got last year at MFCA, epoxy just takes 5, 6, 8 applications of acetone, nail polish remover.
Sure.
Patiently, yeah, with a swab.
But what was it gluing together?
Well, it was gluing a brass pinned figure.
Yeah, so I have the example I'm thinking of right now is I have a light bulb, 132nd scale light bulb in one of my boxes with a little tiny miniature LED inside of it. If you took acetone to that little acrylic light bulb,
you're going to dissolve it.
Yeah, right. So, but yeah, you know, white glue.
Well, you know, the Reverend Spencer Van Gulik, who I'm fascinated with, I think he was a pioneer in the realm of fantasy modeling, and, you know, did about a half dozen boxes. We have them on boxdioramas.com. And I read an article about him in a magazine I didn't know existed until my buddy Mike Holverson gave me a couple of issues. Concurrent with Campaigns at one point, Philip Stearns was also doing a magazine called Fantasy Modeling. That's the only write-up I've ever seen on Reverend Van Gulik. He was a great modeler. Shep admired him. Shep included several of pictures of his work in his dioramas book. I wound up at a bargain price with The Hill That Ate People. A little vignette. Well, it's a vignette, but it's massive. It's the size of a dorm room refrigerator because it's 100 millimeters. A kid exploring in the woods at night with a lantern, coming upon this hill that he's going to enter the cave, but it's really a monster that's going to eat him. It's really charming. But Barry, it's huge. And he had glued the reveal in place with hot glue.
Yeah.
Right? Which took me forever to chip away to get the reveal out, to enable the tray to come out, to enable me to replace the lights. But the Reverend was exceedingly fond of hot gluing everything. And, you know, there's like no way to get, I'm going to have to tear half the scene up to get in to put light bulbs in where they need to go.
Yeah. I didn't even know hot glue was a thing back then.
I'm assuming it was hot glue because it wasn't epoxy. It was, you know, hot glue has a particular, like, you can kind of peel it off.
Yeah, except it's kind of somewhat rubbery.
Peel. Yeah. Anyway, I've looked inside the Stearns box, the Van Gulik box, and I've restored one of those twist box for Joe. And Shep built with more of an eye toward the future than the other builders of the time. So in 76, 75, through the 80s, he was already thinking about someday people are going to have to replace these bulbs. And it's a little easier to repair his. Not that it's ever completely easy. Thank God that none of the 14 figures in the monitor turret fell over or were damaged or had lead rot, because you know, you could take the roof of the monitor off, but nothing else was coming out. I mean, it would have been literally impossible because the walls of the turret of the monitor were permanently in place. A little bit easier for some of the other boxes. I had to take the horse out. The only box that Shep did with a galloping horse, Sleepy Hollow, had to take the horse out to get the replacement LED in the pumpkin's head and the LED under the tray to illuminate the owl's eyes. You know, that was fairly easy, some of them. But, you know, doing this work has been great, and I've been chronicling it in a series of blogs that I'm going to post on boxdioramas.com.
Yeah, no, that's cool. It's been cool to watch it.
And you're going to have to do the same when you fix Hamlet up.
Okay.
And it'll
It'll be a while before I can get it, though.
So, well, yeah, but then we'll have all of these as an ongoing thing. You know, I'm going to get Daryl to do the same when he brings the Swampo. Swamp Ogre's going to be a challenge because the monster's eyes are illuminated and there were lights under the water. And
I'd love to see how he put those lights in the eyes. But,
Well, we're going to twist Daryl's arm to take pictures every step of the way.
Of course.
The lights in the owl's eyes are fiber optics. He discovered those at some point mid-80s, and he began playing with those.
Mid-80s is when they became big. I don't remember when they exactly when they came out, but I remember when modelers started putting in, them in aircraft cockpits. It was the mid-80s.
Ah, yeah. Well, I remember those. You used to be able to buy those fiber optic lamps for your cool bedroom, you know, along with your blacklight poster, like a flowering bouquet of fiber optic light.
Right.
Yeah.
That was the main way to get the fiber optics for a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. Now there's a couple of great websites that offer all sorts of sizes.
Mm-hmm.
So with any luck, you know, at MMSI this year, we'll have a half dozen of Shep's boxes on display, lovingly restored. Many people haven't seen them since he first showed them at a show in 76 or 79 or 80, unless they were lucky enough, as I was, to get to Ralph's basement. I'm sad you never got to make that trip with me.
Yeah.
I know Daryl was there several times.
Yeah, I would love to have seen that.
Well, we're going to replicate it as best we can, Barry. None of this is bragging. All of this is about, you know, we didn't buy them so we could say, we own them, we own them. No, we bought them so we could share them with people again.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
You know, I don't know if the smell will still be in them, but I'm not going to open the box for people that, I swear, that's true. This has been a fun episode, and I hope people enjoyed it. Any questions about restoring box? But Joe says anybody who needs a box fixed, I should make myself available. $100 an hour plus supplies.
Wow, yeah.
But you could do it. You know, so could Dennis and so could Nick Infield, depending on what part of the country you're at. If you need a box diorama fixed up and restored, we'll hook you up.
I can be the Central West representative.
Central West. I'm in the Midwest. East Coast goes to Dennis Levy. Canada's Daryl Audette, and Nick Infield's out. You know, LA, California. Yeah, we got to cover. There you go. Yeah. Where else? Unless Wen went to Europe, I'm happy to take a trip. I should have $100 an hour, supplies and travel.
Right. Yeah, that's important.
Yeah, that is important to say. As always, please leave a message on the Small Subjects website. You can click through there and go to Tell B like David Bridges did. Thank you to the Shep Payne Education Fund for helping make this show possible. Thanks to Mike Hillary. Thanks to everybody who partook in the auction for Shep. Really proud that we got to rescue these pieces. And no thanks to IPMS.
We'll see you next time.